There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
You're listening to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, a condensed version of this morning's full show, and what a spectacular show it's been. We'll get Brandy's take on the North Korea summit in just a couple of moments' time. First of all, these are our headline stories.
Dubai Eye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae.
US President Donald Trump says the historic summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has gone better than anybody could have expected.
More than half of UAE employees expect a salary increase this year. Close to a third of them think it could be as much as 10%. That's according to a survey from Bate.com.
Fly Dubai passengers can now check in their baggage from their home or hotel. Donata has recently bought a majority stake in a local baggage logistics company, Dubs.
Seven UAE exchange houses won't be offering remittance or wage payment services this morning. It's after the central bank downgraded their licenses for anti-money laundering violations.
Nikhil has begun work on a 450 million dirham bridge to link Dera Islands to mainland Dubai. It's going to open in 2020.
And Abu Dhabi's NMC Healthcare has signed a deal with the partner in Saudi Arabia to expand in the kingdom. NMC is teaming up with the General Organization for Social Insurance, the largest pension fund in Saudi Arabia.
Dubai Eye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae. Compare insurance for your car, health, home or business with insurancemarket.ae.
So, Brandy, you've been on Trump Watch, you've been on Kim Jong-un Watch this morning. Pick the bones out of all that lot.
Oh, where do you even start? I mean, whichever side of the fence you sit on as to whether the summit was a good idea or whether it legitimised the North Korean regime, it has been a historic morning. We've had the two leaders, President Trump and, of course, the North Korean leader, Mr. Kim, sit down for a one-on-one, which in itself is an unusual way for two leaders to interact. We've had bilateral meetings between the two, and then we've had a massive summit of a document. At the time of us recording this, we do not know what is in the mystery document, but you will no doubt be listening to Dubai Eye avidly throughout the morning. So you will, in a weird twist of the space-time continuum, know more than we do at this moment.
What we do know, though, and we're most excited about the menu, and one brand name in particular that had a great summit.
Do you know what? I actually think that this is a really big deal. We knew they were going to sit down for a working lunch. There was a lot of speculations about whether hamburgers would be on the menu. What was on the menu? Short ribs, a lot of Korean delicacies, pickled cucumbers, and one name, Haagen-Dazs.
We're speculating whether or not they paid for this. Was this one of the greatest product placements in history? We think not, though.
I don't think you could pay for it. I literally don't think you could pay for it. I know nothing about the back sort of room mechanisms here, but I suspect that someone has thought that Haagen-Dazs was a description of a product rather than a brand name, and that's why it's made it onto the menu.
A little bit close to home. Lots of stories actually here in Dubai. For me, the biggie overnight has been the Crown Prince of Dubai, His Highness Sheikh Hamdan bin Mohammed. He has cut the fees for hotels and restaurants from 10% down to 7%. He says this is because we've got such an amazing tourism industry. We want 20 million people by 2020. And he says it's part of a range of measures to make the cost of doing business cheaper in Dubai, to make Dubai more competitive. Given that it's such a big deal in Dubai, this is big news, Brandy.
It is. And it comes on the back of the freeze in school fees that we've seen. It comes on the back of changes to aviation fees, some of the municipality fees. I feel like this is part of a much bigger jigsaw, but at a time when we know that people are very concerned about rising living costs, I mean, a lot of talk obviously about VAT since it came in at the beginning of the year, these are actual costs in what you are paying for products.
And Sheikh Hamdan is clearly aware of that. He says this decree will expand the series of measures announced days earlier and aimed at supporting companies operating in Dubai, reducing the cost of doing business and attracting new investments. That's at Hamdan Mohammed if you want more on that.
Speaking of hospitality, we had a very special delivery into the business breakfast this morning, and it was the first officially licensed products to come out from Dubai Expo. Fittingly, because it is Ramadan, it was a box of dates, and not just a box of dates, but a box of Batil dates, because Batil is one of the official licensee partners for Dubai Expo. So on one hand, it is a traditional Ramadan gift, that sharing and giving that we know goes with the season. But on the other hand, this is the sort of one of the first really, want to say commercial, and I don't want to use the word commercial with Ramadan, but I feel that this is a big move for Expo, because we know there is going to be a whole range of products, of gifts, of foodstuffs that are going to bear the official Dubai Expo seal, and we're lucky enough to have the first one?
We do have the first one, which raises the question. There are three Business Breakfast presenters, but just one box of dates. Have you got that box of dates, Brandy?
If you go to Twitter, you will see the Business Breakfast presenter that does have the box of dates. That's all I'm going to say.
Malcolm Taylor will be enjoying those at Iftar tonight.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
Having a look, though, at what made up our exceptionally busy show this morning. We got some great analysis from the Asian editor at CNN, Andrew Stevens. He's a longtime business journalist, and he now covers the continent for CNN. He's in Singapore. He's one of the 3,000 to 5,000 reporters that are covering the historic Kim Trump summit on the ground. He gave us his view of what it was like to be there in Singapore today, as well as the background that has led up to this meeting.
What we know is the historic moment has come and gone. Donald Trump met Kim Jong-un. They looked each other in the eye. They shook each other's hands for some 10 seconds. It seemed to be a quite a cordial, indeed quite a comfortable meeting between the two, given the recent history between these two. It was only just a few short months ago they were hurling insults at each other, and there was a genuine threat of some sort of military escalation on the Korean Peninsula. Fast forward a few months here now in Singapore, Donald Trump saying to the press in just a very brief sit down while Kim Jong-un was beside him, saying that how honoured he was to be sitting with Kim Jong-un, and how he was looking forward to having a terrific relationship with him, while Kim Jong-un said that there had been so many obstacles put in the path towards this summit that they had overcome them all, to which Donald Trump actually raised his thumb. So the immediate reaction from the watchers was that the body language was good. There was genuine warmth there. And why does this matter? It at a normal summit with world leaders, the personal chemistry perhaps not so important, but it is paramount in these talks. Donald Trump has put his own interpretation, his own intuition ahead of a meticulous briefing from his aides about how to deal with Kim Jong-un. So it was all about first impressions. It was all about whether Donald Trump, as he said, could do business with him and he would know in the first minute. So they then went into a private session, just the two of them. Again, this is unusual. Just the two of them sat down with their interpreters for about 45 minutes, and now there is a working group happening. And this is where the details come in, and the devil is really in the details with this. But Trump has been joined by his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, and John Kelly, his Chief of Staff, and Kim Jong-un is with his senior advisors. And they've got 1.5, perhaps 2 hours to thrash out some sort of agreement, some sort of way forward, which we don't know at this stage what that will look like, but there are expectations there will be a communique towards the end of this. Kim Jong-un is actually scheduled to fly out of here in just a few hours' time, and Donald Trump actually brought forward his departure date by some 12 hours. So there's a level of confidence in both camps that they can actually get something done. As Donald Trump has been tamping down expectations, he's been saying this is just the beginning. This is the first step in a multi-stage process. So the expectations are lowered. But having said that, we are expecting some sort of communique to come out, some sort of roadmap. It may be a general roadmap about the way forward now.
What's the best end goal, the best case scenario for both sides at the end of these 5 hours?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the best end goal from the US side is the phrase CVID, complete verifiable, irreversible denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. This has been the mantra of the US, and it was repeated as late as yesterday when Mike Pompeo spoke to the media. But that has morphed from being, we want this, a hard and fast signing off on this at this summit, to it's the overarching goal. It will happen down the line. So that is what the Americans want. And for an electorate and upcoming elections, Donald Trump can turn to them and say, I brought you peace in our time, virtually. For the Koreans, And again, this is where it gets tricky. For a start, we don't know just how sincere and how genuine the Koreans are. Are they really going to turn their backs on a nuclear deterrent, which they have put at the very heart of their philosophy? They put at the very heart of everything about North Korean regime. They truly believe, they are truly paranoid in that they think that North Korea is a target for invasion, that these military exercises that we see annually between the South Koreans and the Americans are actually a rehearsal for full-blown war. So are they prepared to leave that nuclear deterrent or let it be broken up? And if they are, what assurances do they have to get? What security assurances do they have to get? Are the Americans prepared to pull their 30,000 troops out of South Korea? Are they prepared to pull back their nuclear umbrella, which covers many countries in Asia, including South Korea? So these are huge issues that need to be done. And the North Koreans also want economic action. Kim Jong-un, at the beginning of the year, said that it was now about the economy. In his news address, he said, I want to focus on pulling this incredibly impoverished country out of its position. They want economic growth. The only way to get that is sanctions. We heard from Mike Pompeo yesterday saying there is going to be no move on sanctions until we have had this CVID. So there's a clear roadblock right there. So either side have got a lot at stake, but obviously the North Koreans now want to normalize not only their relationship with the US, but their position in the world. Kim Jong-un has already scored a major, major coup in the fact that he's met a sitting US president. His grandfather wanted to do it, the founder of the country. Kim Il-sung wanted to do it. His father wanted to do it. They both didn't. The younger Kim has tried and succeeded in doing this. He is now has some form of legitimacy, which he didn't have just a few short months ago.
Presumably, one of the big challenges here is not only in reaching accords in this meeting and future meetings, but making them stick.
Yeah, verifiable and irreversible. They're clearly spelt out on the CVID. And yes, that is going to be a work in progress. Who monitors that? Does it come down to the IEA? Does it come down to the UN? Does it come down to the Americans? All these issues. I mean, it's not that difficult to hide a few kilograms of enriched materials, you know, fissile material, which can be used quite quickly to rebuild a nuclear device. So these are all the sorts of steps that have to be taken. It has to be completely transparent. That's what the Americans are saying, to get to that point. You know, this is an incredibly secretive regime. This is a regime which is an international pariah, which is, we're talking about, you know, if we spoke about North Korea, we talk in terms of a repressive, brutal dictatorship. So there has to be a certain amount of goodwill on the Americans' part to actually see beyond that and see whether the North Koreans are prepared to do this. As I said before, this is such a big change in their own philosophy, in their own survival instincts, to turn their back on a nuclear deterrent. So to do that, you know, there is so much skepticism, and there should be that skepticism, because at the moment, you know, there's a lot of talk. There's been a couple of tunnels blown up. Pyongri nuclear site in North Korea has been blown up. But we've been down this path before. Just a few short years ago, the North Koreans wanted denuclearization, and they blew up some cooling towers as a part of the six-party talks. That went nowhere. So we're still very much in that phase where, is this another false dawn?
Before we let you go this morning, I mean, you're one of, sounds like, 3,000 plus journalists in Singapore this morning. What's it actually like to be there in this? I imagine it's quite a spectacle. Security must be high.
Security is high, obviously. I think it's between 3,000 and 5,000 journalists here. It's incredible in the fact that we are sort of sitting in the front row of what could be a true historical moment, the denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. Just being here is obviously a thrill, and, you know, in so many ways that's what we sign up for, to make sure we can be a part of these sort of stories. The security's it's everywhere, but it's not particularly impressive. The Singaporeans are pretty good at managing these sorts of events. They've done it before with big events involving world leaders. They know how to do it, what to do it. But the sheer sort of almost bizarreness of the fact that you have Donald Trump meeting Kim Jong-un just sets this apart from normal, if you like, sort of geopolitical meetings at this level. So it's been extraordinary to be a part of it. And CNN obviously has a very big team down here. We're sort of trying to cover from all angles, but so many others do as well. And it's one of those stories where you're not getting a huge amount of information from the Americans, certainly very little from the North Koreans. In fact, just one little aside, I mean, the North Koreans invariably, when there is a big event involving Kim Jong-un, they will wait until after the event has happened to actually report on it, and then they can spin it any way they like, and it was a failure that nobody will ever know about it. This time, very unusually, they have been broadcasting stories about Kim Jong-il flying to Singapore, doing his walkabout, where he was sort of treated with almost rock star status, which was also another surreal moment, and planning to meet with Donald Trump before it happened. So this sort of, you know, journalists were picking this up as this is a sign of optimism, if you like, from North Korea, that they think they're going to get a sort of deal done because they're prepared to talk about it before it happens. So they're the sort of straws in the wind, if you like, that we've been looking for. So there's a lot of sort of whispers within whispers and smoke and mirrors. It's been fascinating to report on. And, you know, Donald Trump, the material leader that he is, you never know from one minute to the next, quite literally, as we saw the G7, what he's going to come out with. So far, everything seems to have gone according to script.
Andrew, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, the CNN Asia Pacific editor, Andrew Stevens, in Singapore, where that summit is taking place. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
Here in Dubai, we've been celebrating local innovation on the Business Breakfast. Speaking to a company developing an electronic motorbike, particularly for the delivery industry, those delivery fleets bringing you your iftar, what it happens to be, here in Dubai. A company called Solver Technologies has developed these bikes. Yusuf Al-Abad was in the studio. He's the co-founder. He was also in with Tariq Ahmed Fuad, who is the venture growth manager at Shira. Now, that is the Sharjah entity that's just given Yusuf and his company $50,000. We found out why.
First of all, tell us about Solver, your electric motorbike company. Where did the idea come from and what stage are we at now?
For sure. I'm a grad from Masdar Institute, which is a sustainability institute in Abu Dhabi in collaboration with MIT, where I studied all about sustainability, and I've been surrounded by all stuff that is related to the environment. When we came and looked at the industry, we identified certain gaps when it comes to the logistics industry and the efficiency of the industry, from which we came up with an electric motorbike that is more than just an electric motorbike. It's a full platform solution, data-driven and blockchain-driven solution that will help in increasing the efficiency of the logistics and last-mile delivery in the region.
And you say you got the idea sitting at a traffic light in Sharjah where you live, and there were lots of delivery bikes, be it Deliveroo or Uber Eats or whatever it may be, and you thought, look at the amount of carbon they're pumping out. There's got to be a better way to deliver lunch.
Yeah, that's also thanks to my co-founder and who happened to be my brother as well, Mohammed Al-Abd. When we were together in the car on the signal and we opened the window and we were both suffocating from the amount of CO2, but at the same time impressed from the fact that no one is actually doing anything when it comes to motorbikes, especially the delivery segment of it.
So, Tariq, if I can bring you in now. Tariq Ahmed Fouad is the Venture Growth Manager at Shira Entrepreneurship Center in Sharjah. Tariq, good morning. Thanks
good
for
morning.
Joining
us. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Why did you think that this was going to be the winner of your funding round? Why did this win $50,000, around about 200,000 dirhams from you guys?
Sure. For us, the criteria for getting the grant was basically the involvement, partly the involvement of the team within the program. So it's a 3 months intensive program where we take the company from from strategy down to execution and making it work on the ground. And we take in every cohort, we take in around 10 companies. So the 10 companies really do compete on who does the biggest change on the ground. Another thing is, how does the vision of the company fit the overall vision of Sharjah? And sustainability and environmental impact is one thing that Sharjah holds dear to its heart and that want to contribute to it.
So Yusuf, you've got this $50,000, 200,000 dirhams. Tell us what you're doing with that money, because while the idea came from Sharjah and the company's based in Sharjah, you're making the bikes in China, aren't you? How does that work?
I would just love to break the question and make sure I understand, is what are we going to do with the 50,000 grand? First, I would love to thank Sharjah for the trust in Solva. The first thing we're going to do is to make sure that we're bringing to the client the best reliable solution. So with the help of Sharjah and our partners like the giant British Petroleum and Masdar Institute and company, we're going to start in optimizing and adding value and enhancing the product and the platform and the solution that we are bringing. At the same time, we'll start bringing into the market electric bikes and start phasing out some of the existing piston engine bikes in the market.
They start at around about 10,000 dirhams, don't they? And they go up to about 35,000 dirhams. There's various models that you're producing. Talk to us about the production of these bikes in China. How are they being made?
Definitely. So we have signed partnerships with top manufacturers across the globe. We have suppliers from the US. We have other suppliers that supply us products and chips, electrical chips from India, which flies all the way to China at a city called Xiamen, where we do all the engineering and last type touch of engineering and assembly of our bikes, which we then marry them to the platform that now we are actually producing, that brings all the smartness and the engine that drives the all optimization and data-driven analytics for the bikes.
What about the bikes actually in practice? What's the range on them?
When we first started, we went out actually and we did a market sounding that drove the overall R&D process that we have done. When we went out, we noticed that the average range in the UAE would go between 70 to 120 kilometers per day. Our bikes do 70 kilometers per one battery. They come with two batteries, so on a swap, they do around 140 kilometers a day.
So you can swap out one battery while you're charging
yes.
the other. What about maintenance? Because presumably they've got less moving parts in them.
Definitely. I think we will smash a piston engine when it comes to maintenance. We have no engine oil, no clutch, no gear. We barely have maintenance cost, which we do to our clients and promise on-road assistant, whatever down or problem that you're facing with your bike, we fix in 20 minutes.
They'll be. I'm assuming that they're very quiet.
It's quite interesting. I saw a bike once on the roads of Dubai and I went to do a real case with the rider and he told me there's a problem. The bike doesn't have sound. I was like, I was actually impressed by the reaction of the rider because there's also a culture understanding and shift. And the bike is awesome. There's zero sound when you're riding it.
But I'm thinking then about safety for pedestrians, for people to get out of the way if the bike is coming. I mean, one of the few complaints that people have here about the sudden rise we've got on delivery is maybe some of the skills of some of the drivers. How do you get around the safety issue?
Definitely, that's something very important. We actually just finished drafting the safety and health and safety requirements and environment requirements for Solva organization in a whole. And safety comes as a top priority for Solva. One of the things we're doing is we're controlling the bike speed through the data analytics system based on certain areas across Dubai. So, for example, if we know the bike now is riding inside Marina, for example, and it's an area that occupied with people, we limit the speed of the bike to not cross what we call a dangerous zone where they can easily stop the bike.
Final question, when are you going to make these in Sharjah, if at all?
Definitely having that backward integration will start for sure, and we want to be a UAE R&D and produce technology. It's a part of the vision. We're also now opening another office in Abu Dhabi, as we're now just started raising our $2 million seed stage, which we're now capturing lots of attention after Sharaat trust in us.
So give me a year. When can we expect these things to be made in Sharjah?
Let's ideally, we would want to aim for 2020 to have our presence in the UAE, where we can start assembling at least the bikes. But we're for sure going to aim aggressively to have them before that.
Malcolm has one question. He's very keen to ask. As a keen motorbike rider in the 70s, and we've all seen the pictures of him, the sound is part of the appeal, isn't it, Malcolm? The roar of the Harley or the Triumph, that's the appeal, isn't
the
it?
The noise is part of a bike. I mean, how are you guys going to compensate
definitely
for that?
Definitely. I'm a rider myself. Yeah. I have my own Harley Davidson as well. It's a quite a nice game when it comes to the delivery industry, where it is driven by the economics of the bike rather than the sound of the bike. Clients care about how much money they pay to deliver the bike. It's a volume, a high volume, low margins industry. And this is where we're tapping into.
It's a great initiative. Appreciate you joining us this morning to share some details. First of all, Yusuf Al-Abd, the co-founder of Solver Technologies, appreciate your time this morning. And also Tariq Ahmed Fouad, Venture Growth Manager at Shira. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
This weekend should see the introduction of the UAE's federal arbitration law. It's been a while in the making, but it is going to change business here in the UAE, or at least when business goes bad, disputes. Bill Smith is a partner at the law firm Pinsent Masons. He's been in the studio to explain to us what this new law is going to update.
The new arbitration law effectively replaces the law governing arbitration in the UAE, which was in effect for the last 12 years. It will replace that law with a modern progressive arbitration law based on the model law which was recommended by the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. So it will really bring the UAE into international standard in terms of arbitration.
What provisions does it have in it that the previous legislation didn't?
Right, so one of the, I suppose, key things is a modernisation approach. So what we're seeing now is, in terms of hearings, whereas before they would have to be taking place in person with everyone in front of the tribunal, now what you can have is actually a situation where you can be done by video, Skype, video conference, so not everyone has to be present in the same room. Another thing that's come in is that whilst arbitration agreements still need to be written, the United Nations approach to it, which is it can happen via emails or during an exchange of letters, making it a bit more fluid as to how that arbitration agreement can be formed.
Am I right in thinking that under this you can also choose who you want to be your arbitrator, you can choose which system you want to cover it?
Absolutely. So arbitration is effectively a private means of dispute resolution, and what the law now enshrines is that the identity of the arbitrator can be anyone, can be any ethnicity, any background, and that's a real progressive step.
Do you have to decide all that at the time of signing a contract, though? Which country's system is going to govern your case? I mean, that's not something presumably that you can decide at the point that you're having the dispute. Does that have to be written down beforehand?
Actually, it doesn't, but from a practical perspective, obviously it's best to agree all of those things at the outset, because what we find in practice is once the parties have got themselves into a position where they're already in dispute, they're unlikely to be agreeing on anything. So trying to agree on the language of the arbitration, what the rules of engagement might be, and who the arbitrators might be is going to be very different once there is a dispute in place. So much better to agree all of those things in your agreement from the outset.
So what does it actually mean for businesses? Does it mean that arbitration will be quicker, easier, cheaper, more effective, more binding? What?
Hopefully all of those things. What you've seen in the past are some reasonably archaic practices. So, for example, one thing that used to occur was that arbitrators would have to fly into Dubai to sign the award and deliver it to the parties. Well, that's now going to be, you know, abolished into the past. And what you have is that the award will be deemed to be made at the seat. But with all of the, you know, technological innovation, what you're going to get, I think, is an efficiency. The biggest efficiency I think you will see is after the arbitral process is concluded. because the enforcement regime is now going to be much more streamlined. So you've got a 60-day process for the decision to be coming out on enforcement now.
And also for challenging as well, a 30-day limit.
Absolutely. So another key innovation there.
What does this mean for Dubai's ambitions to be an international arbitration centre? Because that's what we want at the end of the day. We want other people to bring their arguments here.
It's absolutely terrific news. And I think that's the key message here is that, you know, Dubai has bucked all trends in terms of FDI. And I think when you're looking at the legal sector here, everyone's up for this. It's going to bring arbitrations to the region because it gives you that international basis of model law, which business knows and recognises and really accepts.
Over the years of the Business Breakfast, we've learned how sort of complicated dispute resolution is and how many different stages there are. There's negotiation, mediation, arbitration, expert witness, court decision. Does this law cover everything or just simply arbitration?
It covers just arbitration.
Yeah.
So the other forms of ADR aren't really governed by this.
But would they need something to govern them just as much as arbitration would?
It would be helpful if there was something in place for those other forms of dispute resolution. What effectively arbitration is it's taking away from the natural jurisdiction of the courts. So similarly with expert determination or dispute adjudication boards or mediation, it would be great to have a framework around those things to give them greater certainty of enforcement as well.
Are there any other areas that the new law doesn't cover? Anything more you'd like to see?
I think that with many things, there's always more things that you'd like to see. I think probably it would be remiss not to mention the issue of authority of to bind parties to arbitration. In repealing the arbitration law, one thing it didn't do was repeal the need for a special authority to be given to the person signing the arbitration agreement. So because arbitration does take matters outside of the hands of the national courts, it's very important for parties to make sure that the person from the other side signing the agreement has the special authority to bind their company to arbitration.
So what does it mean if you're currently in arbitration at the moment? Does the law covering you just suddenly change?
That's a great question, Brandy. The answer is yes. So as of Saturday, this law now will apply to all the arbitrations presently in play. And so if you look at some of the changes that have coming in, for example, costs which previously weren't going to be available to you if you were successful in your arbitration may now be recoverable. So that is a key change.
Wow. And what about stuff that's been heard in the past? Can this be applied retrospectively?
The interesting grey area there is really where you've got an award that's already been delivered and hasn't been enforced yet. Now, constitutionally, the law can't apply retrospectively, but I think people will be definitely sharpening up their pencils if they have an arbitration award in their cupboard and seeking to get that enforced pretty quickly.
Bill Smith, partner at the law firm Pinsent Mason, speaking to us about the UAE's new federal arbitration law, which will come into effect on Saturday. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Brandy.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
We've been looking at an extremely exciting innovation in the Business Breakfast studio this morning, one that personally we can all see the potential of, that is transferring air into water. That's what Verigan Water Solutions says that it can do. David Painter, the chairman, was in our studio. We asked him, what's the story?
The story is we're really just replicating what happens in nature by converting moisture into clean drinking water via a process of water generation.
I mean, obviously, we're on very humid days here in the Middle East. Glasses and windows steam up when warm meets cool. Is it the same process?
Very much the same process. It's really blasting hot air at cold surfaces to produce moisture. We take the moisture, clean it, store it, then mineralise it, sanitise it again, and then it's ready for drinking.
Well, I mean, we do, obviously, on a very hot summer day here, water runs down the outside of our windows. We've got the AC on, pretty cool. But, obviously, you're using a lot of energy to throw cold at warm. Doesn't that defeat the purpose of being green and a way to create water?
Well, our objective is to be fully sustainable, and using renewables, we can be. The worst-case scenario is to use a diesel generator, but most applications now are using solar or hydrogen is the latest generation of energy that we're using in the field.
Just give me a sort of feel of the scope of this. I mean, do you do it in something in a small room? Is it on a desktop, or is it a big industrial application?
Well, in the micro sense, we produce units that are standalone and produce around 1,000 litres a day.
How physically big would that be?
That's the size of a small car.
Okay.
Approximately.
Yeah. And that's 1,000 litres a day.
That's 1,000 litres a day of clean, mineralised drinking water. And on the macro scale, we can build water farms that can produce limitless amounts of water because the humidity is limitless. And that can be used to serve the grid or alternatively for bottling, glass bottling, hopefully, or some other renewable, sustainable source.
So just put two and two together for me. The sun bit, the energy from the solar panel. How big an area of solar panels would you need to power enough or to create enough water that would feed, say, a small village?
Well, if you came to the 1,000-litre unit, you would need approximately, if you took a 40-foot container, covered it in solar panels, that would provide enough power.
So, I mean, if you looked at villages, say, in Africa, they could become sort of self-sufficient. You could get some energy and water out of nothing, effectively, apart from a bit of investment.
Yeah, that's our objective, basically. And the plan is basically to make these units fully sustainable and they're at the point of need rather than shipping in crates of plastic bottled water.
It's a great idea. It's not necessarily a new idea. We've had other companies in this part of the world touting this type of technology 3 or 4 years ago. I remember there was a French company, Eol, that was offering a very similar type of technology, humidity converted into drinking water. Others do this as well. What makes your technology better or different?
Well, the product was originally developed by a doctor, and his objective was to provide very clean, mineralised drinking water of very high quality.
Everyone's objective is that?
Absolutely. Well, we've realised that objective by basically coming into markets such as the Middle East and having the water tested, independently tested, and meeting the criteria of organisations like DEWA. We actively sell to major organisations such as UN, NATO, and others. And I think probably from what we see, we're the only company that has a product that is being adopted on a global scale.
Are we in a VHS versus Betamax type phase for this technology at the moment, where there are various competing ways of doing this and one will end up becoming the definitive global standard? Are there different ways for producing drinking water from humidity?
There are lots of systems out there if you search the internet. We feel that our water generation system is the future because it's very scalable and it can be developed. And the current technology is now leading us to new surface technologies which can produce much more water for a given space. So we expect our, for example, 1,000-litre machine to be producing up to 3,000 litres within 2018.
Given that the air is nitrogen oxygen, presumably the oxygen bit contributes to the O part and the H2O that you're creating, you've kicked off in March in the Gulf in conjunction with Kestrel Global. What level of interest have you actually seen? What actual market penetration have you achieved so far? Where are they working?
The interest has been significant. We have units on trial at places like Expo 2020. As a result of the Dubai Future Accelerators, we're doing pilot schemes with DEWA, and a number of other organisations now are understanding the technology and seeing the applications.
I'm interested in the DEWA story simply because on the surface you might sound like competition for DEWA, the Dubai Electricity and Water Authority, but in fact you're actually working in conjunction with them. What are you doing and what are they doing for you?
Basically, the UAE GCC water strategy, water and energy strategy, covers existing technologies. Our plan is, in association with DEWA and similar organisations, is to add air to water as part of that water security strategy going forward.
When am I going to be having one of these in my back garden or on my balcony so I can use it at home? When will you reach that level of micro scale?
We see the units being consolidated into building and housing developments. And as you know, people don't drink from the tap in Dubai or in the GCC generally. And the plan is to have a third tap, which would have Verragon water piped into properties, either apartments or housing developments, offices.
And what would that cost me or Malcolm or Brandy? Per day, per month, how would you bill that?
That could either be billed through a utility company or alternatively it could be billed direct. Typically, we recently became a finalist in the XPRIZE competition, which is a global water competition. And we're looking at target water costs of around 2 to 3 cents per litre. To give you some idea of the costs. So you compare that with plastic bottled water, it's a significant advantage.
And there's no plastic bottle, which is another significant advantage.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming in, David Painter, Chairman of Verragon Water Solutions. We look forward to having you back in the studio, perhaps, when things are a little bit more developed and closer to perhaps being delivered to our houses. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Funnily enough, that's The Water Music by Handel.
That's it for the bite-sized business breakfast. We will be back tomorrow morning on air and online. Have a great day.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.